Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench.
Hello, welcome back to Fighting on Film. Now, this week we have a very special guest with us. Chris Richards was a supporting actor on Masters of the Air, and he's joining us today to tell us all about the goings-on on set. Now, before we begin, don't forget you can get 10% off at checkout on airfix.com by using the code FOFPODCAST. That's FOFPODCAST, all caps, all one word at checkout, to get 10% off some model kits courtesy of Airfix. Chris, it's fabulous to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I think we were talking before we were recording. I think you're one of the few listeners turned guest, which puts you in a very exclusive club. We'll have to get the special badges made up at one point.
Oh,
I think. Yeah,
that'd be great.
So, firstly, I mean, a simple one to kick us off today. How did you get involved in the production?
So, I mean, way back in 2019 was when I first got involved with supporting artist work or extra work, whatever you want to call it, with 1917, Sam Mendes' film, which I got on for 3 days to film the big charge at the end of old George Mackay running across the battlefield. So I was in there in the deep background, so you don't really see me in that one. But that's how I sort of got in through an open casting in Salisbury, near where they filmed. And it's one of those things, once you get extra agent, then you're in. You know, they send you alerts. They, you know, you have your profile, you've got your pictures. And I think it's through key casting that I was informed about this. Actually, in the, I think it was the December of 2020, I first came across what was then called Whirlwind, was its working title. And at first I wasn't sure, because they said it was Second World War soldiers, you know, there'll be battle sequences, all the sort of, you know, it's very vague. And I was like, I wonder what this could be, you know, because I hadn't heard much, you know, and I thought, I'm going to do a bit of digging. And then I heard this, they're planning or starting to film this series, Masters of the Air, or what, you know, what there was some talk at one time, it called, might be called the Mighty Eighth, whether that was true or not, I don't know. But the series called Masters of the Air. And I put two and two together. I thought, actually, I was thinking Bomber Harris with Reap the Whirlwind and that whole, you know, connotation. And I thought, sounds like something that could be aircraft related, you know. And as that was the big thing coming up, I was like, right, I'm going to apply for that, you know, because I've loved Band of Brothers. I mean, Band of Brothers is just, you know, and Pacific is one of those incredible, you know, they're incredible series, momentous series in their own right. And to hear it was being made by, you know, the same exact producers and, you know, a writer who was involved, you know, John Orloff, who was involved with Band, it was, you know, it's one of those things, those once in a lifetime things. I thought, this is going to be big. And I really want to, you know, not just because I love the series, but I've always been fascinated with Second World War history. You know, I had a relative who actually served in the RAF, who was a sergeant with 427 Squadron, killed on his first mission over Germany, unfortunately. Wow. So it was, even though I didn't have any relatives who were in the American Air Force, it was still quite a personal thing. So I sent in my headshots, you know, I sent in, you know, my availability and all this, and it went quiet, as is the case often with that sort of thing. And I waited and I waited and I thought, oh, blast, I haven't got in. It's gone, you know. And then I got sent another availability request in, I think it was like the January or February time in 2021. And of course, we were mid-pandemic at this point, so I was interested to see how that panned out. And so I again sent in my availability, and they said, well, we want you to come in for a fitting. I was like, oh, good sign, you know. So I went to a fitting at, there's a studio complex in Aylesbury that I think belongs to Apple, and went over there, had to do, I think, 2 COVID tests before they let us go on site, which was quite a, you know, I mean, and that was a reoccurring theme throughout the production, except right towards the end, I think it went down to 1 and then a test on the day. But yeah, it was 2 COVID tests. And then finally we got to the fitting, and I went in there, and there were loads of us there, and we all went in, and there was a chap, I presume he was one of the assistant costume designers, was looking at each one of us who went by and said, you know, you're going to be ground crew, you're going to be a military policeman, you're going to be whatever. And it got to me, and I actually, I was wearing my glasses at the time because I hadn't yet started wearing contact lenses. So I quickly took them off, you know, to make it look a bit as it would do. And they said, a medic, I think, just like that. And that, with that, my fate was sealed. And at first I was like, oh, that's interesting, you know, a bit different, you know, unarmed, you know, doing something a bit different, because as I say, in 1917, I was carrying Lee Enfield all the time. So, and I went in, they sort of swapped around various costumes, and, you know, they had this whole, it was like an aircraft hangar full of, you know, every sort of costume, and not just American, there was British stuff there, there was German stuff there. It was mind-blowing. I mean, incredible, the amount of stuff they put together. But in the end, they settled on giving me this M41 jacket, and the old enlisted trousers. And the M41 jacket was Tech Corporal, so 2 stripes, which I was quite pleased with. I got a couple of stripes to my name. So I was given that. And I actually, for the first time, I had a change of costume. So I had the 4-pocket tunic as well, for sort of, you know, if you're out at the pub or, you know, special events or whatever on the station, which actually it turns out I didn't use very much at all. I was more in my work clothes, if you will, for most of the series, which was good because it meant there's quite a bit of action going on. So yeah, that's how I sort of fell into it, really. And from there, I just, they said, we like what you do. They kept the moustache, which I went in unshaven, and they said, you might be good with a moustache. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, I'm not usually one who has I'm not one for facial hair, but I'll do it. You know, I'll go with it. But the most embarrassing thing was they said it's not dark enough, so we'll have to dye it.
Yeah.
They put this foul-smelling stuff to basically make it look a bit darker on camera, because it hadn't really properly grown out at that point. I'd only just started growing it out, and they still kept doing it throughout the series, but, you know, I mean, it looks good on camera, so what the hell?
So when you're on set, are you stationed there? Are you staying in accommodation, or are you coming and going back home every day? How does that work?
It depended really. So if we were shooting at, in some of the shooting was done at the Chiltern Open Air Museum, or the back of the Chiltern Open Air Museum, where they built the entire sort of the barracks, the, you know, briefing rooms, the briefing huts, you know, all these Nissan huts, the post offices, literally all this stuff that was built up as the production went on. And that was the main sort of, you know, base life scenes without the planes. That is not that far from me. I mean, it's quite a, you know, an ironic thing, because I live not far from Hatfield, de Havilland's at Hatfield, where, of course, Band of Brothers was filmed. And yes. So, yeah, and that's another reason I've sort of grown up with that. And then I went to Newlands, or Chiltern Open Air Museum, which was where that was filmed. So that was a short trip away, and I went back and forth from home there. That was fine. The stuff that was shot at Abingdon, so Dalton Barracks, as it's known now, I think, where all the, you know, all the replica flying fortresses, the control tower was, all that stuff. I had to stay down there because commuting back and forth to Oxford was a bit of a bind, and I just thought it'd be easy to stay down there. So, you know, I hopped around different hotels and rental rooms in order to do that. But I was, you know, I was glad to do it. I loved every minute of it, so it was worth doing.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But, and being a medic, I was based solely, so that I pretty much stayed on the base throughout the thing, whether I was a medic or just generic background. So I never went to any of the prisoner of war camps that you'll see later in it, unfortunately, you know, but because I would have looked out of place, I guess. I'd already been featured, so if I'd suddenly popped up by accident in, you know,
Stalag,
wherever, yeah. It would have been an interesting, you know, thing. How did you get there?
Very much.
Obviously, they picked you out as a medic and they made you a tech corporal. Did you get any other insights into the group you were with, your individual character? Did you come up with anything yourself? Did you have a little mind cannon for the individual that you were playing, that kind of thing? How did you kind of get into the mindset of it? Did you have any of the training that Dale Dye and his company put together? Because I know that you sent a question in when we talked to Dale a couple of weeks ago. Definitely, if you haven't heard that episode, go back and check it out, folks. Because Dale remembered Chris, and that was he gave a lovely little reply about the stretcher scene that you did.
Yeah, so that's an interesting one, really, because I mean, I wasn't given a character. I mean, I was given sort of the very, you know, anonymous moniker of Medic 02, I think, was the character name, which was, I thought, was a bit amazing, you know, generic. So I actually, because I mean, it's interesting because my background or rather what I really want to do in film is sort of the art department side of things. Mm-hmm. So I decided to sort of make a bit of a character, try and get dog tags made, just build up this sort of, you know, fictional person that I could, you know, inhabit, you know, when I was on set, you know. So I came up with a tech corporal called what's his name? Joseph J. Clark. Of Aurora, Illinois. So he was the character that I made. And I did a lot of sort of background research into the role of the medics, what they did, you know, how vital it was, you know, and also into sort of the character, you know, what the character sort of mindset would have been, that sort of thing. And even down to sort of little details. So when I had the dog tags made, I got it accurately done to a conscript from that area, the number, the prefix is like 3-6, I think. So I did that. So I went into a lot of, you know, detail in trying to make the character. And then when it came to the training, Dale Dye sort of, he gave us an instruction on the stretcher bearing, how to carry it appropriately, how to get a guy out of a plane without causing more injury to him, which is a difficult job to do. I mean, people are all, you know, arms and legs, and trying to get them through a small, you know, aircraft door is quite a
having
job.
Having clambered through one last week, definitely attests to it, but not being the easiest thing to get in and out of, that's for sure.
Yeah, if you were like a, you know, dead weight, essentially, you know, getting it, that the little hatch is going to be a bit of a problem. Yeah.
So, I mean, that was quite a thing. And we had a bit, most of the instruction was a bit off the cuff when we shot the scenes. So it's like, you know, this is what we need you to do. This is, you know, how you'll do it, this sort of thing. So we had a bit of instruction, which was good. And it went very quickly, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, the whole atmosphere with the sets, with the replica forts, everything like that, you really sort of, I mean, I know it sounds cliche, but you sort of forget you're being filmed at times. I certainly found this anyway. I don't know what it was like for others, but you get so, the adrenaline, I think, of it particularly, it's one of those things, you know, I was in the mindset, there's somebody in that plane who's wounded, need to get them out quick. You know, that was all I was thinking. I think it shows, I mean, the urgency of it, you had to be quick to get those guys out because you need to get them to aid, you know. So yeah, it was one of those things you really get carried away with. And I mean, we did a few takes of that stretcher bearing scene. I think they actually used the first one, which is often the case with, you know, that you do multiple scenes and takes, and then they use the first one because I remember it well. But I think on the last one take, David and I came up to me and said, he was like, right, guys, we're going to go for one more take, so don't fuck it up. He said, so, I was like, oh, God, pressure much, you know. And I mean, working with him, I just got to say, was incredible because I'd known him from Band of Brothers, you know, I've heard of him, and from Saving Private Ryan. I was like, you know, it's one of those sort of like hero, you know, oh gosh, it's Dale Dyne.
Absolutely.
You know?
So
that was that sort of, you know, awe of him in that regard, and also the pressure of trying to do the scene. And in that take, I remember the life jacket strap, I think, got caught on the handle of the stretcher, and we had to stop and do it again. But it was like, don't worry, kid, it's all right, you know, we'll go again. And I was like, oh, thank God he's not going to tear a strip off us.
Obviously, you have a director there, you've got a crew, but in that scene, is Dale acting as sort of a liaison between you and the director in that? How's he doing that in that? Because it sounds like he's more involved than I thought he might be in that sequence.
So, yeah, in that sequence, he was, I mean, there pretty much most of the time. It was a very sort of, I think, partly because of COVID, but also partly because of the nature of the scene. It was quite compact in that, you know, focusing on that one aircraft, which I think was Wild Cargo, if I remember rightly, on that one aircraft, that one crew, getting them out. So it was a sort of, the crew was all around us, behind us that whole time, including Dai, who, you know, between takes would come over and say, you know, you're doing really well, or, you know, you need to, you know, lift up a bit higher or whatever. So he was very much, you know, hands on there on the ground, which was a great help, you know, and certainly instilled confidence, I think, in certainly myself, but, you know, also I think in the other guys I was working with, because there are a few of us who worked as medics. So,
yeah. What's the biggest challenge for you on set? Anything really difficult that you had to sort of get over or work with?
Gosh, well, one of the difficult things I found is emotionally, actually, at times, which is an interesting point to make, because, for example, particularly that scene with the Barnhill crash, actually. And I don't know why, because, as I said, I was already trying to get into this character a bit and put myself in the mindset. But the sort of the context we were given, this plane has just crashed, you're going to help, but they're all dead. And that really hit me. And I felt, you know, I got really quite emotional thinking, there's nothing I could do to save this. If this is a real situation, there's nothing I could do to save these men. And I remember having to take a minute after shooting that, and I was like, oh, that's, you know, got me more than I thought it was going to do. And I think that's testament to how well they created the atmosphere, how well we were directed, that, you know, even as just an extra, you really got emotionally caught up in it all.
Yeah.
So that was a particular challenge. I mean, otherwise, it was, you know, with being an extra, you sit around a lot for a long time. It's long days of not doing much, and then you might be called to do something. By and large, they were pretty good. We were used a lot. I will say that they were quite. It was quite smooth and quite, you know, prompt turnarounds, which was great. So the crew was really, really great with that. But I decided at the start of the production, in the sort of idle moments, I started doing sketches of sort of, you know, of the sets, of the aircraft, of, you know, people on occasion. And I did it as the character, interestingly. Mm. So I drew it not as if, you know, with the cameras in the background or, you know, the actors standing around with their visors on for COVID or anything. I drew it as it would have been seen in, you know, 1943. So this was one of them there. So that was
great.
Yeah, this is one of them. And I'll post pictures of them later on, I expect. But I throughout this thing, to pass the time, I just did these sketches, and it was just sort of, you know, something to get away, you know, take myself, you know, away from, you know, and sit down between lunch and, you know, between, you know, breaks between in filming. I just sort of sit myself somewhere like in the ambulance cab or, you know, on the back running board or wherever, and just draw whatever I saw, you know. And I kept doing that for most of the production. And actually it ended up, because as these things do, it got shown around a bit, you know, people like, oh, you know, look at this guy's doing, you know, something different. You know, some people read, some people played cards, but I was just drawing all this stuff. So Dale Dye saw it, and he seemed pretty, you know, impressive, which was quite, you know, I was quite touched by that. And a chap called Mike Stokey, who was another sort of assistant military advisor, I believe. And eventually they ended up showing it to, so this was right at the end of filming. This sort of came, you know, to a head. And they showed it to Tim Van Patten, the director, and I believe it ended up getting shown to Gary Gutzman as well.
Oh, cool. Oh,
lovely.
By Dale. So I was touched that little bit of stuff that I just did, you know, for the fun of it, really, sort of ended up building into something special. Now I have it as a sort of reminder of, you know, the
nice
series.
Nice memento,
and a little sort of, you know.
But nice, yeah, really nice. Mm, that's lovely.
Yeah, so that's the way to pass boredom on set, you know, that and reading, you know. But that's the main challenges you face, really.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello there, sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support, now back to the show.
Hello, I'm Al Murray, and you're listening to Fighting on Film, the world's number one war film podcast.
So, having seen up to episode 5 now, what do you think of the show so far, Chris?
I mean, I'm, you know, obviously biased.
Apart from when you're front and centre, of course.
Being in it, but I'm blown away how, you know, it's all come together in the way it has. It's just, I mean, having seen it, bits of it that, you know, I was involved with, you know, there are other bits I saw being filmed, but how it's all come together, the way it's been edited with the music and, you know, and sort of the colour grading and everything, it's a beautiful piece of television to start with. I mean, visually, it's incredible. And what they've managed to achieve with, you know, I mean, there's a lot of debate about the CGI, and I know that's been a huge bone of contention with a lot of people, but I think that they've been able to put up entire squadrons of flying fortresses, you know, in you know, a raid on, you know, Munster or Schweinfurt or wherever, is it's the likes of which we haven't seen in a long time. I mean,
I mean, let's face it.
Yeah.
So
I don't know why people get so annoyed about it.
It's weird.
It's just people. I don't think the people who've seen sort of say Memphis Belle or things like that, they've seen the real aircraft used. So that's what they've seen. That's what they like. And I guess this new technology, this whole new thing, it's different. It's out there, and it's you know, it takes some getting used to, I guess, for a lot of people.
I think some people aren't willing to dispend their disbelief a bit. Sometimes they want to be too critical, and it's like, well, unless you're going to make and produce, you know, 15 or 20 B-17s, which isn't going to happen, like, how else are you meant to do it? You know,
well, quite,
It's one of those things.
I mean, what they did do with the replicas that they built, I mean, these two full-size replicas, which we got to see very up close, you know, we you know,
yeah, tell us about those. Over them. Definitely want to hear about those.
So, I mean, the first time I saw them, I was like, oh my God, this it genuinely looks like you could wrap your knuckles on it, and that had metal, you know, sheeting or metal skinning on it, which, you know, it gave it the right sound. It wasn't like fiberglass or something like that. It was, you know, it looked real, smelt real, you know, it had that, and they weathered it so well, you know, and they put on bullet stripes and all this sort of thing, and it just looked utterly incredible. I was like, that's a work of art as it goes. And I think it's a company called BGI Supplies made them, and the effort that's gone into it, and even like, because we looked up inside them, you know, and the cockpits have been fitted out, and, you know, the gun positions, the waist gun positions have been fitted out, and the tail gun. And I was like, on most productions, you just basically have a steel frame in it with nothing in it. It would just be a trundling, you know, like an exterior visual replica. But it was kitted out, and we saw that in great detail with the replica 50 cals on there, the blank firing 50 cals on them. It was astounding. And it really helped you get into that, you know, into that headspace, interacting with a real replica aircraft, you know.
Wow. It's a no expense spare kind of production.
No.
So when you're on set with, you've got those replica ones, how many genuine B-17s did you see? Did they have any at the actual place, or was it all done in post? Or
so, well, unfortunately, I never saw a real, you know, an actual flying example. Or, you know, I believe sort of there was a period during one of the air shows where people got pictures of Sally B among the replicas, which was quite a nice sight to see. But I think they decided, it seems like they decided, for continuity reasons, they've just, you know, they based it mainly off those replicas and CGI examples. Because, as I say, it was those two replicas that I saw. There was, I think, a cockpit section that could be raised and lowered to make it look like it was taking off, which was, that was pretty, you know, crazy to see. I mean, and good for the actors in the cockpits, you know, actually, you know, getting a sense of that takeoff a bit. So, and they actually made at least one of the replicas fly, as it were, you know, inverted commas, by lifting up with a crane. And we saw that, and we're like, oh my God, they're actually, this thing is now hanging in the air, you know, above Abingdon Airfield. And it was just like, you know, if you ignored the crane, it was like it was coming in on approach. And that was, again, that was quite mad. I think they used that as sort of like a marker for doing the CGI, doing that post-production, you know, as a sort of, you know, something to model off. So that was interesting. But yeah, it was just those two replicas and a cockpit section on Abingdon. I know there was stuff in the studios as well. And I think later on, but I didn't see it because I wasn't involved in those bits, they had Spitfire Mark 9 and P-51 or two as well, and a P-40, I think. So they did use some real aircraft later on, but it was just, I think, as I say, for the continuity of the look of it, they kept with the replicas and the CGI. So, which makes sense. It's fair enough.
So on set, you mentioned that some of the main cast there. How do you have any interaction with them, or are you kept separate? How does it work?
it's interesting, really, because I mean they only come on when they're needed, really.
Of course, yeah.
Those things a bit like us, but even more so. They're sort of driven up to the set. They come out of the car and they get ready.
They get the VIP treatment.
And so we did see them around. It wasn't so in between the takes. We weren't kept away from them. In fact, no, I went up. I spoke to Anthony Boyle, who Crosby, of course, in the series. Yep. Who, I knew he was an Irish actor, but he'd been speaking an American accent so long throughout the production that I was like quite sort of set off kilter by him when he's talking, in his normal voice. I was like, oh, I've seen you in a load of stuff, big fan of yours, and he was really lovely and very understanding. And it's one of those things you're like, do you go up and talk to them? Because you're worried, there are probably some actors who are very, oh, you're an extra, go away. Or, it's like there's a divide. But with him and with quite a few of them, there wasn't really that, I mean, Austin Butler, I think, as I recall, was very method in his approach to it.
And makes sense.
I remember having to, if we did speak to him, we spoke to him in character, which was interesting. As I recall it, I remember, there was a lot of talk about that going around. And, if you were filming, I think when we were doing the stretcher bearing scene, he was close by. He wasn't in that shot, but he was like, are you okay? Are you doing okay? And, corporal and things like that, it's right. Like, yeah. It's just quite nice that he actually sort of checked on the extras, which was quite cool.
I think it's been documented that he, he did have issues with sort of giving up that Elvisness. So I guess the methodness of it must be a thing that he does. I think it's what he's probably becoming known for.
I didn't really notice that Elvis. Yeah. I mean, I hadn't seen him in biopic actually, of course, at that time. But I mean, I just I thought it was just perhaps a slight exaggeration of his normal voice. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, maybe.
Callum Turner was an interesting, because he's British, and another one who, between takes, you occasionally hear him speaking, with the British drawl, and it was like, oh yeah, there's another Brit, another Irish. I mean, and Barry Keoghan was is Irish as well, so there's the whole mix of, it's not just Americans, which is the same with Band of Brothers. I mean, Damian Lewis.
Absolutely.
It must be somewhere written that, the quota of British actors has to be a certain amount for a play tone a play tone production, perhaps, because it seems that way going forward. If we get a naval one sometime in the future, who knows how many British character actors are going to pop up.
So obviously we've talked about the stretcher scene, but where else can people spot you in the show?
So a lot of it is sort of quite far background. There is, so in episode 5, just after Royal Flush has landed, I don't want to give too much away for those who haven't seen it, but I suppose listening to this,
it's been broadcast, so you're weapons free to talk about 5, no problem.
So yes, when Royal Flush makes its landing, the last aircraft back, I am running around the side of the ambulance. I get out of the cab and I run around the side to the back of the ambulance there. And I've got quite a distinctive, because I look quite distinctive, and we saw that. I was like, yeah, so that's me there. But interestingly, the actual stretcher bearing in that scene was filmed on a different day. I happened to be in Kent on holiday. So I missed that, unfortunately. Yeah. But I am in the start of that scene. And I mean, that goes to show sort of the continuity and how, piecemeal it is, different bits shot on different days.
So you talk about that scene. How are you? So that scene obviously is very emotionally charged, and it's the only bomber to get back. And, as the audience, we've seen the battering it's taken. Yeah. On the ground, before they shout action, are you being given sort of direction, being like, this is very peculiar, this hasn't happened before, this is something that, how are you prepared for that as a supporting actor?
So they do give you some context about what's happening, particularly with scenes like that, because as you say, it's particularly emotionally charged, very, you know, dramatic and unusual scene. We're told, you know, this is the last aircraft and the flight's come back. You've been waiting for all these, you know, guys to come back to Thorpe Abbotts and they're just not there. There's this one plane that's, and even that is really badly shot up. And, you know, they leave it a lot up to you, you know, to sort of, you know, how you react to it personally, of course. So, I mean, it's one of those things I was like, in that situation, you know, I'd be pretty cut up that people that I would have seen on base, you know, people I would have known, people, you know, I'd have shared, you know, breakfast with in the mess hall potentially. They're not coming back. They're gone.
Mm.
And we don't know if they're dead, if they've been shot down, the prisoners of war, you know. And once you think about that and really get into the mindset of what that, you know, what you can imagine it, because you can't truly know unless you've been there, of course. But when you try and put yourself into that mindset, you sort of think, God, the sense of urgency about trying to find, you know, see who's left, you know, who, you know, what state are they in? What do we need to do? And the rush, the sort of urgency of we need to get these people out, you know, that is probably really badly shot up. I mean, just looking from the aircraft. So that was the key thing that was drummed into us, the urgency of it. You know, there are men's lives at stake. You know, in the real world, there would have been men's lives at stake. And that is, you know, when you think about it, that's a hell of a thing on a person's shoulders to think about. You know, you are the difference between you might get this bloke back and save his life, or he might die, you know. And so that's what was really, and it was particularly poignant, as I say, in that scene, you know, because they were the last men standing from that flight that had gone out. So, yeah, we were told this is a really, you know, unusual event, and you're going to be really sort of horrified that you expect, you know, that we're told you probably expected it to be bad, but not this bad. Like, you didn't expect, you know, almost everyone to have gone. Like, that's a hell of a thing, you know, to think about.
No, massively. And how did you feel about seeing yourself in the opening credits? How did that hit you?
I mean, that was, you know, it's one of those things, because when we saw it originally, in fact, I first saw it in the trailers, because of course the stretcher bearing scene was in the trailers too, in a couple of the trailers. So that was like, way, you know. And then there was that scene, I was like, that looks like me, and he's standing like me, and I'm pretty sure he's got a medic's armband on. And I looked at my notes and I was like, yeah, there was a day when we were shot from the front, you know, doing this stuff, but it was a bright sunny day, just to spoil the illusion, you know.
There's like, post-production trickery there. Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. And I was like, I'm pretty like 99% sure it's me. And then purely by chance, I think I posted a picture of it on Twitter, on X or whatever it is now. And this guy got in touch. Actually, it was about the stretcher scene, actually, and said, I worked on the VFX on this scene, as in the bullet damage on aircraft, the shell damage on the plane. And then he also said, and I also worked on the fog for this scene. So I composited the fog into the scene. I was like, oh my God, you know. And it's like, so the big question, is it me? And he confirmed, you know, having seen it, you know, he was sure it was. Because, of course, he did a lot of scenes. But they work on a scene for a long time. You know, I imagine, you know, so much work goes into it, especially to add a big, thick English pea super fog. So he obviously spent a lot of time looking at that one scene, which is like, you know, crazy thinking about it. But yeah, so that I had that confirmation, and I was like, so that definitely, you know, it is me at the end. Wow. It took on a whole new thing, because then I was like, well, that's in the opening titles as well. And every time we watch it, my parents will go, way, every time we see it. And it's just amazing. It'll stick, you know. I mean, even though I can't see my face in it, it's just like I can still point to the TV and say,
yeah,
I'm, you know, there. What it was. Yeah. It's being there, being involved. And I'm so glad to have been involved with it, because it's just, as I said, I think in the one words review thing about how it's been so monumental and momentous as well. It's such it's one of those landmark things.
Of course, and, you know, being immortalized forever in the intro, you know, which is which is sort of, you know, these intros do become their own little thing. And I think the Master of the Air intro is no different, you know, in terms of its sort of what it does for a show. And I think it's very powerful. And I was quite critical of it early on because I was thinking, oh, it gives away too much. But it actually, the more I see it, I don't think it does. Like, it gives you this, you know, if you've seen the series, which, you know, me and Matt are fortunate enough to have seen it, all of it, it does give you quite a quick, how the whole series goes. It gives you quite a little bit of an insight, but it also just documents those key moments, and it shows the figures that aren't necessarily at the forefront of our minds when we think of the series. We're thinking of, you know, Austin Butler, we're thinking of the pilots and the crews, but it shows the people loading bombs onto the bombers. It shows, obviously, you as a medic. So in its own way, it's showing the people that made it all run, which I think really helps and enriches the show. But I didn't think that maybe 6 weeks ago, but now I'm seeing it every time I watch it. I'm like, actually, this is doing a lot more than I thought it was. It's a good, it's a great sequence.
I mean, that's one of the things that really impressed me about the series. As you say, it focuses, you know, there is focus on the ground crews, you know, the guys who, you know, still stayed there on the base waiting for them to come home, or got up early in the morning to bomb up the aircraft, fit the bomb sites, you know, all that sort of thing. And it shows, I mean, there's particularly, I do like little vignettes of, you know, in the sort of briefing rooms where all the equipment's been handed out, or, you know, the maps are being, you know, slipped along the desk, or, you know, anything like that. And I actually got to go into those sort of, you know, the operations rooms and the, you know, the offices, and the attention to detail in that was just astounding. I mean, they had, you know, some of it has been posted, I think, on the Master of the Air Facebook group, which is a great group, actually. I recommend for any fans of the series. But, like, you know, down to, you know, exact documents of for the particular raids, you know, it's got all the sort of the correct wind speed charts, it's got all of that was there, completely, you know, in line with what was going on in the episode. And that was just like the effort that went to that, the graphic designers, and say, as somebody who wants to work in the art department, that side of it really impressed me. I was just like, wow, they clearly, the passion is there, they've researched their stuff, and it really shows. I mean,
as we talk about on the show, like, it's that, as Matt says to me every week, that mise-en-scene, it really adds a lot to a series. Like, it take it for episode 5, for instance, at the end in the interrogation hut, there's a board full of posters, and one of them is Luftwaffe uniforms. And it's such a small thing, but it does so much for the you know, as I say, the mise-en-scene. And it's not really for the common viewer, but the real nitpickers, the real people who want to beam on in, it's there. Don't worry, you know, it's there. They really thought about this, and it's quite something. It really enriches a program. So what's next for you in terms of your supporting actor career, your fledgling film career? What's up next, if you even can share it, if you're even under any NDAs?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to find more steady work at the moment in the meantime, because it's one of those things between productions you have to, you know, and I'm now at this moment doing work in a library, so a bit of a change from acting a medic, but still a great job there. But I always keep an eye out, because it's what I've researched, what I'm particularly interested in. I do sort of period war stuff, you know. So what with 1917, then Masters, and if anything like that comes along, I sort of sign up straight away, at least, you know, submit an application and submit my headshots and things. So I'm hoping there'll be something, you know, another project coming up at some point soon. I mean, I worked on something last year, which I can't talk about. It could be coming out in the summer, though, I believe. So that'll be, you know, so again, military role, but different, quite a bit different. So yeah, that'll be good to see. But it's a matter, as I say, I mean, either going down the supporting artist route or following the sort of what I want to do in the art department. As I say, it's a difficult industry to get into. It's very, you know, it's quite a challenge.
I know that. Crikey. Yeah. Failed actor sitting right here.
Yeah. Well, you know, future actual extra work, you could, you know,
well,
you sign
never up. Know. Maybe one day. We keep threatening it, don't we, Matt, to every director we talk to. Like, next time you make a war film, stick us in a gun line. So that was an absolutely fascinating interview, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope everyone's learned a lot more about what goes on behind the scenes on Masters of the Air. And don't forget, you can listen to our weekly episodes on the show. We're at episode, I think, by the time this drops, maybe episode 6 or 7 will be out. But don't forget to leave a review for the podcast wherever you listen. Follow us on the socials. And once more, thank you, Chris, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thanks, Chris.
Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.